In our study of the Hadith, the traditions about Muhammad's words and actions, we've looked at the life of the Prophet, his personal life, the emphasis on the supernatural, not only in the life of Muhammad, but throughout the Hadith, and then we return to the issue of the extreme reverence paid to this figure. In our next section, we examine Muslim belief and practice, and that's where the second podcast ended. Now, we're going to look at women and family, violence, and Jesus Christ. Those three final categories in our study of violence. Beginning with women and family. The family, the household in ancient society, actually as in much modern society, consists of more than just a mother, a father, and children. The family could be quite extended. And we would be guilty of anachronism if we didn't understand that servants were part of the household. And servants are to be treated kindly. I read that in the third volume of the Hadith of Bukhari, kindness. Marriage didn't mean necessarily just one man, one wife for life, the Christian idea. The Quran says that women, up to four women, can be married by a man. But there is a restriction in the Hadith about a man and a woman who were both suckled by the same mother, the same nurse. And if they married, then they must divorce, because it's as though they were brother and sister. Muhammad gave his wives the option to divorce with substantial endowment, not just to kick them out, but apparently they had the right to significant support if they were divorced. And women could inherit, just as in the Old Testament, women were allowed to inherit. Well, on a general note, Muhammad disapproved of the killing of women and children. And as the movement of Islam grew, there was more and more killing. This was frowned upon and taught against. Another thing that Muhammad tried to stop was the practice of burying one's daughters alive. You may think of your elementary school studies when you studied Greece and how the Spartans, if the child was weak, would abandon the child on the hillside. You're probably aware of the forced terminations and drownings in Asia, in places where, well, they just want a son. Daughters have never really been the first choice in worldwide culture. And apparently in Arabia, pre-Islamic Arabia, unwanted daughters were buried alive. Horrible thing. This is a reminder of the level of barbarism that was there, how far we've come since then, we hope. Muhammad taught that all are born Muslims. We're all Muslims. At conception, your gender is not determined. Gender is determined, well, actually, there are different views on this in the Hadith. One is that it's not determined until 12 weeks. 12 weeks is even later than the view of the ensoulment of the future human. The Hadith teaches it takes place at 40 days, or possibly you could read it as at 120 days. But at the point of 12 weeks, or 84 days, the gender is determined. But another Hadith says that it's actually determined when the parents have intercourse, depending on whether the male or female discharges first. So you've got a mixture of speculation and pseudoscience. Certainly, these are things we're all interested in. Maybe they did their best, but there's nothing here, or for that matter in the Quran, that makes me believe that this is the word of God. Apparently, Arabs practiced and Muslims practiced coitus interruptus. This was defended by this Hadith. There is not a soul who is to be born for the day of resurrection, but that it will be born. In other words, with a strong emphasis on fate, Allah holding the future in his hands and trusting him, no one would be born who shouldn't be born, and vice versa. This Hadith has been used to overcome objections to birth control because, you know, God is in charge. Of course, by that reasoning, we could overcome objections to many things and many wrong things. Well, paradise, as in the Quran, may be a band of brothers, though we remember that the women are still present there. But are women full participants in the faith? Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, takes the place of jihad for women. The hadith tells us that they didn't take part in the holy war themselves, except maybe to bring water to the warriors during the battles, as did two of Muhammad's wives. But when women went on the Hajj to Mecca, for them, that was their jihad. Jihad is simply the word for striving, as in self-control. We're trying to get justice on the earth. We're trying to control our own passions ourselves. But the way it's almost always used in the hadith, just as in modern parlance, is holy war. Conspicuously, women must travel with a man, and no man may be alone with a woman. Obviously, we're not talking about a husband and a wife, but women must travel with a man. That practice probably jumps out more to us Westerners than the perhaps unstated views about, you know, when life begins or, you know, what the hadith said about burying daughters alive. The other thing that's fairly conspicuous is the hijab, the veil, the full body veil which the Muslim woman wears. Women not being allowed to be alone, without a, you know, traveling alone or being alone with someone that, you know, that she's not very closely related to, strikes Westerners as quite harsh. And the wearing of the hijab strikes Westerners, most of us, as highly restrictive of her freedom, though I don't think all Muslim women feel that way. However, I don't think that we should equate the wearing of the hijab with modesty, though that is the idea. In the Middle East, in my travels, I've often seen, especially among the wealthy, hijabs that were very revealing, that clung to the body, that reveal shape, covering up women who were clearly heavily perfumed, wearing expensive jewelry, trying to have attention drawn to themselves. So just because the body's covered doesn't mean that God is pleased. Perhaps Westerners overreact. But let's admit it, our own treatment of women as objects is deplorable. Our tolerance for advertising, pornography, the depiction of women as objects, which really dehumanizes. And I think some women don't get that, and most men don't get this, how horrible it is. Neither culture, Islamic or Western, is balanced. So the big question is, did Muhammad respect women? You know, what did he really teach? Well, at times he seems to listen to his wives, his favorite wives. But overall, I'm not fully convinced. For one, he taught that women are only half as intelligent as men, and their legal testimony is worth one half that of a man. There was one occasion when a dignified woman, she was a princess, was brought to Muhammad to have sex with him. But she was reluctant. She was reluctant just to give herself to Muhammad. He became angry, and he raised his hand to beat her. Well, you're probably aware that in the Quran, it's one of those notorious verses, 434, the passage where you rebuke your wife if she does wrong, you can beat her, send her to beds apart. That is, you know, she's not going to be sleeping in your bed tonight. You're probably aware of that. That's a passage that many Muslims have tried to explain away. In fact, just yesterday I was watching an online video by a Muslim defending physical force. He was saying just as governments have the right to use force, think of the police, for example, to prevent society from falling into evil, so men as heads of the family have to be able to use force. Now, he insisted it's a light beating, it would not leave a mark, but there's nothing wrong with it. He defended it. Other Muslims have a different response. They'll say, well, it's not translated correctly, which I don't buy that. Or they'll say, well, times have changed, we've moved on. Some translations of the Quran try to play it down, but I think those who are honest about what the text says cannot play such games. The Quran teaches it's okay to beat your wife, and the hadith say the same. Muhammad also said, another reason I'm not sure about respect, he said that many men have reached the level of perfection, I'm not quite sure what that is, but the level of perfection. I just know if he was talking about me, he wouldn't have included me in there. But he said, though many men reach it, no women reach that level, with three exceptions. Aisha, that's his his child bride, his favorite wife. The wife of Pharaoh, why exactly, I'm not sure. And Mary, daughter of Imran. Mary, this is the sister of Moses. And in the Quran, Surah number 19, it's the mother of Jesus. Well, they're the same people because it's confused. So men reach the level of perfection, but women don't, with just three exceptions. And if that's not disturbing enough, I found four, maybe even five hadith that where Muhammad has a vision of hell. And he sees in hellfire that the majority of those there are women. Well, why? He says, because they're so ungrateful. Ungrateful to their husbands. And also there's reference to cursing, profane language. And it makes me wonder, did Muhammad feel his wives didn't appreciate him? That they're there for the sin of ingratitude? Now there I go, almost psychoanalyzing Muhammad, the very thing I've warned you against. But I do wonder, it's quite odd. And how? Here's the thing that's hard to explain. How can each man get two women in paradise? Okay, you've heard about the martyrs, the jihadis, who get the 70 virgins and so forth. That's a different place. I've not come across that passage yet, but I know it's there. But in volume 4, 468, it says that a man gets two women. Well, the mathematics doesn't work. If the majority in hell are women, then in paradise there would be fewer women than men. So how could one man get two women? Because the only way that would work is if women were more spiritual than men, if they were reaching the level of perfection. I just don't think he thought this stuff through. It's a sign that he or his followers, whoever wrote down or possibly created some of these hadith, were winging it, hadn't really thought it through. So in sum, for women, Islam is really a mixed bag. There's some degree of protection against being treated as objects. They have the right to inheritance and so forth. But they can be beaten. They're certainly demeaned in terms of their intellect. Well, they're allowed to take part in the faith, though generally they're separate from men. I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing, the way that they pray in separate areas. And there's some aspects of Muhammad's teaching, no burying of daughters alive, that, he must have really been taking a stand in a very godless society. But his expectation that women would come to him for sex, his view that most of those in hell are women, this is extremely disturbing. The ancient world was indeed barbaric. When we understand that, we appreciate that in the Old Testament, women are treated with much greater honor, only to be exceeded by that of the New Testament. Just think of the way Jesus respected women, the way Paul had this collegiality with women, where almost half the people he greets in his letters are women. He clearly works with them. I think Paul gives women more rights, more responsibility, more privilege than most churches do today, nearly all churches, in fact. So it's on a great trajectory from barbarism to the level of the Torah, then to the level of the New Testament. But the Muslim treatment of women seems retrograde. Should we really be aiming to live by a 7th century ethic? Well, let me explain what I mean by retrograde. If Muhammad is the seal of the prophets, if he's greater even than Jesus, you would think he'd be calling us to a higher level, not a lower level of morality. Both Muhammad, we're going back to, in many ways, to Old Testament or even earlier in terms of the rites. Now, we move from family and women to the sixth area of our examination, which is violence. Let's begin with war. Of course, the Muslims attacked caravans, they attacked cities, they fought in Arabia, and pretty much in Muhammad's lifetime, if not very soon after, the pagans had been expelled from the Arabian Peninsula. If they weren't converted, they were expelled. I mean, it was an incredible conquest. And Muhammad dies in the 630s. By the 640s, Egypt has become Muslim, except for the Coptics, who are holding out, who are just a minority, as today. They move towards Persia. In the 700s, they're as far as Spain. And I even read about a possible naval expedition against Constantinople, the capital of the Roman Empire. Now, I know Rome fell in 476, but the main capital of the Roman Empire was moved in the 4th century to Byzantium, renamed Constantinople. And there's a naval expedition, Constantinople, modern Istanbul, which straddles Europe and Asia, the Black Sea, as it comes towards the Mediterranean. I'll be there later this year. If you've never been to Constantinople, you've got to see it. Clearly a strategic place. And Muhammad has guts. I mean, a naval expedition against Constantinople, and he tries, using an embassy first and then a letter, he tries to reach the emperor of the Roman Empire, sometimes called the Eastern Roman Empire, in Constantinople to convert him. It's expanding. Now, initially, the converts to Islam were more from persuasion. But once warfare was authorized, it really started to grow. And then after that, it seems to me it grew partly because of warfare, partly because of commerce, partly because those conquered by Muslims would pay a higher tax rate unless they converted. They became Muslims, they had a lower tax rate. That's always a good motive, isn't it? Everyone thinks about ways to cheat death and taxes. Muhammad is portrayed as a man of war in one of the very memorable pictures. This is as an older man. He's come back from battle. His head is wounded. His helmet is smashed. Blood streaming down his face. A front tooth has been knocked out. He's a man of war. He taught that jihad is the second best deed that you could possibly do. Another hadith says it's the third best deed you could possibly do. You know, pray at the appointed times, keep your duty to your parents, and take part in jihad. If you are called for fighting, go forth immediately. One of the seven most destructive sins is running away from the enemy and war. You do not turn back. And war meant killing. I don't know how you could have war without killing. Fight the infidels. Allah's apostle said, I've been ordered to fight the people until they say, none has the right to be worshipped but Allah. You know, fight the infidels until Allah's religion reigns supreme. In a different hadith of Tabari, killing disbelievers is a small matter to us. And I think that once Islam got the taste of, well, success, the scent of blood, the awareness that they could become and were becoming powerful, war was, well, really, there was no thought about it. They attacked without warning. You know, in the Old Testament, if in the very few times when Israel was authorized to fight, because it's simply not true that, they were always engaged in a holy war. But against the Canaanites, and this is from Deuteronomy chapter 20, they had to, well, with the Canaanites, they just went. But for the other peoples, they made an offer of peace. You know, they offered terms. So they knew they were coming. And the truth is, even for the Canaanites, they knew they were coming. I mean, read the beginning of Joshua, Rahab and the gang, they know that they're coming. And there was the possibility, theoretically, that they could escape. I mean, look what happened with the men, you know, who pretended they came from far away. Is it Joshua 9? You know, who are those men? What are they called? I'm drawing a blank right now. But you know, that trick. So there was a way around it. But in the New Testament, fighting? Warfare? What is that? I would like to, well, firstly remind us of what Jesus said about loving the enemy and turning the other cheek. Because I think way too many churches are not really that different from Islam in their conniving at violence, their justification of, well, let's just say, equating the state with their religion. Okay? Oh, the Gibeonites. That's what I was thinking of, the Gibeonites back in Joshua. But what did Jesus teach? What did Paul teach? There's a fairly long section I'll read in Romans 12, and I think this is very helpful. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Well, that's what Jesus taught. Paul continues. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight. Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, declares the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. So without taking any more time on the issue of warfare and whether Christians are allowed, and in my book, Jesus and Islam, there's a chapter on not just Islamic violence, but our response. You know, should we turn the other cheek? I think the scriptures speak fairly clearly. I'm simply making a contrast here. Muhammad allows what Jesus and the apostles forbade, and the spirit in which warfare is conducted is just not right. Now, you weren't allowed to attack a fellow Muslim. The hadith says you just don't do that. I wonder myself, what would Muhammad say about the fighting today that goes on between Sunni and Shiite Muslims? You know, the killing. And I think if it's true that many so-called Christians hate Muslims and many so-called Muslims hate Christians, but even stronger is the, you know, the antipathy that's more, you know, internecine, the intramural disputes, Sunnis hating Shiites, Shiites hating Muslims even more than they hate other people. This is not right. Well, directly connected with warfare is martyrdom. And the martyr, the mujahid, he goes to paradise. The Quran teaches this, of course, for example, in Surah 3, but it's all over the hadith. Martyrdom and jihad is better than the entire world. It's worth more than the entire world. Reminds me of the passage about the hair of Muhammad. The mujahid receives honor from Allah, so much so that he would gladly be born and die in battle and be born and die again 10 times for the honor he has. And this hadith, I think, captures the jihadi ideal. Paradise is for him who holds the reins of his horse to strive in Allah's cause with his hair unkempt and feet covered with dust. Paradise is for him who holds the reins of his horse to strive in Allah's cause with his hair unkempt and his feet covered with dust. We have this image of the wild warrior on the way to martyrdom. Well, if martyrdom is held up as an ideal, if warfare is justified, it's not surprising that execution as well. Muhammad gives execution orders, and once he became powerful, he would not allow himself to be mocked. He would not suffer fools, and he would order executions. And I think we're aware that Islam teaches death for apostates, certainly for all apostate males, even if they've only been Muslims for the space of 1 hour, they must be executed. No compulsion in religion, really? What about mutilation? In one place, Muhammad forbids mutilation, but he doesn't seem to have followed the rule himself as he orders the hands to be cut off a woman for stealing. And you can see this also in Surah 5 of the Quran, you know, chopping off hands and feet. Or just as an object lesson, just to make a lesson, a point in a lesson, a boy is decapitated. And it's nothing, you know, just to make a point. What about retaliation? Well, unfortunately, Muslim followers were, let's say, just on track with the rest of the world in retaliation. Lex talionis, you know, the law of retribution, of replying in kind. Now, at least one time, Muhammad suspended lex talionis. This was in a case where, well, it was a tooth-for-tooth case. You know, one person caused another person to lose a tooth, and he said, nah, let's not do that. But overall, no. He follows lex talionis just like anyone else. And more, he prayed for his enemies to be punished. He didn't pray for his enemies, like Jesus taught. He prayed for his enemies to fall down. You know, it's certainly worthy of the most intense of the imprecatory psalms of the Psalter. One time, quite memorable instance, some youths were playing a trick on Muhammad. He's praying. So, you know, you imagine his back is flat. His body is very controlled as he goes up and down from standing to, you know, to lying down. And they know he's not going to break ranks. He's not going to stop praying. They take the innards of a camel. So I imagine camel's intestines. They put them on his back. They think it's very funny. And it just, they, you know, imagine them just kind of slimy and sliding off his back. And he finishes his prayer. But then he utters an imprecation against these people. And later on, and this is found in a couple of hadiths, their 7 corpses were found in a well. When cursed, he cursed in return. In fact, his final words at death, the hadith says, his last words were a curse against Jews and Christians. Earlier he had called a certain Jew, "O enemy, O the enemy of Allah." I think it hurt him deeply that the Jews of Medina, Yathrib, which he renamed Medina, just means the city, that they didn't follow him. I think he expected more of a harvest among the Jews, but they didn't follow him. And this is probably the most, I think, disturbing. You think I've shared some disturbing things in these podcasts. Well, get ready for this. There were some men who were ill, and I think the Muslims treated them well. They even allowed them to go to their herd of camels to be healed. At that time, they believed you would be healed by drinking milk and urine. Urine, I mean, it is antiseptic. I'm not recommending it or anything, but you know, they had been helped, and they got better, and they were Muslims. But later, they became apostates, and these men killed Muhammad's chief shepherd, and they drove away his camels. So it's chaos. His camels all have run off. His chief shepherd's dead. Muhammad sends his boys after them. They search for them. They chop off their hands and feet, that is all 4 appendages. Then they heat up irons and they blind their eyes. Imagine the red hot iron in their eyes. And as they're dying and screaming in agony, calling out for water, they're refused even the kindness of water. They just leave them in the desert. That's retaliation. Now, Muhammad comes after Jesus. Remember, about 6 centuries after Jesus. And this was supposedly an improvement. This is the greatest of the prophets, even greater than Jesus. So why, again, I ask, why did the level of morality dip below even the average Old Testament level? In the Old Testament, we see mixed levels of vengeance and compassion. Sometimes enemies are treated kindly. Sometimes they're not. Very different to the New Testament because it lacks the politics and the state church or the church state. So if Islam is regressive, if we're going backwards, then how is it an improvement to have Muhammad come along? I think we have to have an ethical sensitivity, and too often Western Christians don't, because we tend to equate the state with the church. We tend to think, well, whatever the state does, as long as they're nice towards me and my denomination, then I support it. That's not really the way the early Christians took this. So in conclusion, is violence consistent with the teaching of the founder? This is the question. Is violence consistent with the teaching of Jesus? In no way. Is it consistent with the teaching of Muhammad? Unfortunately, yes, it is. Now, we have the sword of Matthew 10:34. Jesus says, "I didn't come to bring peace, but a sword." That's a metaphorical sword. It's not a literal sword. The sword is the division that comes when some follow and others don't. But compare this to some of the hadith. The prophet said, "Hear me. By him who holds Muhammad's life in his hand, I will bring you slaughter." I will bring you slaughter? Or another hadith, and it's in the context of insult. You know, the Muslims are insulted and they want some kind of payback, and they're all huffy. And this is what is said. Isn't he, Muhammad, truly God's prophet? Then why should we be humble in our religion? You know, if we're right, why should we be humble? You know, as though, why should we be apologizing for it? We can be proud. We don't need to be humble. How different to the spirit of Christianity. Again, I urge you, read the Bible, read the Quran and the Hadith, and compare. More than one writer has assumed that Muhammad was just obsessed with control. I found this hadith to support that notion. He who obeys me obeys Allah. He who disobeys me disobeys Allah. That simple? And why do people go to hellfire? As one commentator analyzed it, 4% of the hellfire passages really have to do with moral transgression. Someone has just done something completely against God, something deeply immoral. But 96% of the time, and I'm going to quibble about the percentages. This is just what this commentator said. 96% of the time people are going to hell, it is for disagreeing with Muhammad. And that certainly makes it sound as though control was very important to him. And may I add one more thing, since now I'm throwing mud? Before Muhammad, the various religions of Arabia coexisted. You had Christians, even though it was obviously a very fallen, compromised kind of Christianity, but there was Christianity of different stripes and sects. There was Judaism. You had the Zoroastrians. You had the Sabaeans. You had then the Muslims. But before Muhammad, the religions coexisted. There was, in effect, religious tolerance. But this would not be true by the end of Muhammad's life. Religious tolerance is gone. It's gone. May I read one more scripture? And this is from 1 Peter 2. And the context is fighting back even when you're in the right. Because often Christians say, well, okay, I'm not going to defend myself, but if I'm innocent, then I can't let that go. I have my rights. Or I'll defend someone else who's innocent and will use deadly force if necessary. Think about this. When Jesus was arrested, and if anyone was innocent, it was Jesus, he told them, put away your sword. He didn't fight. He didn't even put up a verbal fight. Listen to the words of Peter, who knew Jesus well. But if you suffer for doing good and you endure it, this is commendable before God. To this you were called because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. He committed no sin, and no deceit was found in his mouth. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. Think about what we've just read in this section about war, warfare, martyrdom, execution, retaliation, the pride that will not overlook an insult. And is this not drastically different? What Christ taught, what Muhammad taught and did. And this brings us to the final section, Jesus Christ. Well, Muhammad used to hear the Gospels read in Arabic. See, he finds so many interesting things in the Hadith. When he was younger, he heard the Gospels read in Arabic. And he apparently met a monk when he was a boy, certainly no older than age 12. And there's dispute on what kind of monk this was. Was this Christian really a true Christian, or was he a Gnostic? Perhaps he was in a breakaway group, an Arian, or the so-called Nestorians. Maybe someone who believed things that weren't in the Bible. For example, the idea that Jesus talked in the cradle, which was in the New Testament Apocrypha. That's long after the time of Christ and the genuine Gospels. But Muhammad had some exposure to at least some form of Christianity. He accepts some aspects, but not others. And he borrows from Christianity. I've already mentioned some of the miracles that faintly approximate Jesus' own miracles. I found a variation on the parable of the workers in the vineyard. It was interesting to find. Arabia in the 7th century was a blend of several religions and many polytheists and, of course, compromised Christianity. So again, he's borrowing from Christianity, but I'm wondering, what kind of Christianity is it? He makes the charge that the Bible was corrupted. I think there's a passage in the Quran on that as well. But in the Hadith, it says that the Christians had corrupted the Bible. But, of course, the Quran tells Christians that they should follow the gospel. They should follow the Injil. And since no manuscripts have survived to support the contention that there's been change or corruption, we wonder, well, what manuscripts was Muhammad referring to? I mean, even the Arabic gospels that have survived are nearly exactly the same as the Greek gospels. Muhammad seems, therefore, to have been reacting to the eccentricities or the errors of 7th century Christianity. Catholicism, which was, again, highly politicized and had its pantheon of saints. I can see how Christianity would have felt to Muhammad to be like polytheism itself, praying to all these interceders, all these intercessors, all these saints. And Muhammad cursed the Jews and Christians for praying at graves. Apparently, the Jews would gather at the graves and the Christians would pray at graves. Well, that makes sense. The Christians did start doing that, actually, before the time of Muhammad. And Muslims thought that just wasn't right. But we shouldn't think it's all negative. Jesus is unique. From birth, Satan could not touch him. Muhammad believes some things about Jesus that we as Christians don't, again, such as that he spoke in the cradle. I mentioned before the representations of Jesus. When Muhammad goes on his night vision, the mirage, he sees Jesus with fair skin and lank hair. There's another hadith. It made me laugh. To really talk about the skin color of Jesus, very different from that of Muhammad. And it said that he was red-faced, like someone emerging from the toilet. Okay. Muhammad has some pretty earthy illustrations. He had seen images in a church when he visited Ethiopia. He saw Maria, you know, the mother of God, as she was had been viewed since the 400s. So he'd seen these images. He thought this was wrong. This is idolatry. It's really adding gods to the one true God. But he had seen pictures of Jesus. I think that affected whatever kind of vision he had that night journey on his, you know, when he went up on Burak into the heavens. And whether he is making it up or whether he actually saw it, he believed in, for all intents and purposes, a European Jesus. I mean, a Jesus who I think did look like the Jesus of the Sunday school. And I'm always reminding audiences, he wasn't black. He wasn't white. Jesus was Asian. He's dark. The ascension, we read about the ascension in not just, it's in the Quran, but you know, the Quran and Islam teaches more than just that Jesus ascended. It teaches he had a virgin birth, Surah 19. He was born of a virgin. He was born sinless. He stayed sinless. He was the one whose return would trigger the judgment day itself. So they teach the second coming. The only major teachings that are rejected are crucifixion and because that would be a sign that he was a failure, and the resurrection, and of course the incarnation, which C.S. Lewis says that's the central miracle of Christianity. I'm inclined to agree. God becomes man. You know, that's the unforgivable sin in Islam. It's a central teaching in Christianity. But he not only believed in the second coming of Christ, he believed Jesus would return soon. And it seems in one hadith I found that Muhammad may have thought the world would end in 100 years. That would certainly fit well with his teaching that Jesus would return soon. And if you'd like some useful things on this, there's a good bibliography at the end of Jesus in Islam. But quite a helpful book written by a friend of mine is called Paul Meets Muhammad, A Christian-Muslim Debate on the Resurrection. You can get the information in the notes. In conclusion, there are many other interesting things in the Hadith, and I'll just rattle off a few. He writes the letter to the emperor of the Roman Empire. He writes to Heraclius asking him to convert. Well, that's pretty bold. Muhammad taught that his generation was the greatest generation, and the one after it was not quite so great. And in time, things would really go into declension. And soon, in fact, he says fatness will appear. You know, people will get lazy. They won't be lean anymore. They won't be, you know, busy and active. Muhammad cursed women who act like men. He curses men who act like women. Did I say that right? He cursed men who act like women and women who act like men. Interesting. Why would he do that if people weren't acting that way even in Arabia? He teaches that a mosque was built in Mecca 40 years before the Al-Aqsa Mosque. But I think you may know the Al-Aqsa Mosque is on the Haram al-Sharif, the Temple Mount. The Dome of the Rock is built in the 600s, but that's not a mosque, that's a shrine. But the mosque on the Temple Mount, Al-Aqsa Mosque, is not that old. Muhammad is way off. The mosque in Mecca, and you know, he has Abraham visiting Mecca 40 years before Al-Aqsa. I don't get that. That seems to be significantly off. He's interested in angels and demons. We have Gabriel with 600 wings, Satan, more in the Muslim writings about the devil than in the New Testament. Just as blood circulates in the body, so Satan circulates in the mind. And one interesting hadith, yawning is from Satan. If you yawn, that's from Satan. I found one passage where he was traveling with his friends and they're walking along, I guess it was the sea, they find an enormous fish which is able to feed his entire group for weeks. I think it's clear that was a whale, but he doesn't call it a whale. I guess they hadn't had that experience yet. Probably more significantly on animals, Muhammad sacrifices animals. You have the feast of Eid al-Fitr, where every year the Muslims kill the goat. Muhammad slaughters a kid in sacrifice, not a human, a goat, in Bukhari 3, 497. So if we can just come straight to Allah, we don't need a priesthood, why sacrificing animals? Do they somehow vaguely remember that they need a Messiah? They need a Christ? They need someone to bear their sins? I don't think Islam really deals with this issue of forgiveness. And perhaps there's an opening there for us Christians in our outreach to them. Well, let's close our study by examining a couple of the claims of Islam. Don't be extremist in religion. That's 138. Don't be extremist. Yeah, but it's all relative to what you consider extreme. Most of you listening to these three lessons would probably consider that there's a lot of extremism here. Muhammad is the last and best prophet. Muhammad was sent to all the world, whereas all other prophets were sent only to their own nations. That's also in the Hadith. But this is demonstrably false. A number of Old Testament prophets went to other nations. And even Jesus, though he focused in Israel, sometimes was teaching in the north, in Tyre and Sidon. That's Gentile territory. That's not Israel. So that's just false. It's a sin, the Hadith tell us, to ask too many questions about disputed matters. Well, sure, it's possible to go too far, but I think we should equally beware the authoritarian attitude that values stability over truth, that refuses one to question the system, so to speak, because this plays into the hands of those who will use violence to maintain power. The real contrast we see in the Hadith is not so much between Islam and Christianity. Those religions are very far apart. And I know there are writers like Miroslav Volf who in his book Allah says that basically we're worshiping the same God. And he's good for me to read his book Allah. I got a chance to meet him last year. Reminded me, okay, I could overdo this. Do I want to believe that there are different gods? No, I should be looking for as much common ground as possible. But when I look at the life of Muhammad, when I look at the teachings, the basic teachings, I see the differences far outweigh the similarities. And the contrast is not just between Islam and Christianity, it's a contrast between Muhammad and Jesus Christ. Muhammad, who's very human, very earthy, clearly a sinner, and teaches and does many things that fall so short of the standard of Christ. And you have Jesus, who's, yes, 100% human, but he's 100% God, worthy of our worship. Finally, if you want to learn about Islam, I make this suggestion. Spend some time in the Hadith. I pray this has been helpful to all listening to it.